Welcome to Building Tomorrow, a show where we contemplate what the future could look like if we embrace bold, free, and compassionate policies. Our last episode was about how immigrants built Silicon Valley, something that was possible because of significant border deregulation in the 1960s. And if you enjoyed that episode, go give us a good rating on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. For part two of our investigation, we're going back to college. You know, that place where you played beer pong, tailgate at football games, hit the books in the library every night and studied hard to make your parents proud of your excellent grades, right? Our university system, it really is a marvel, a destination for students from all over the globe. But the university we're familiar with today looks radically different from American universities of the past. That's a product of changes in the mid-20th century that not only created what are known as research universities, but also generated a tremendous amount of innovation. Silicon Valley would not have existed in its current form without them. The most famous of these newfangled universities was Stanford University, which grew from an educational backwater into the beating heart of Silicon Valley. Now, this would have astonished Americans in the early 20th century, who would have assumed that like Boston area schools like MIT and Harvard would continue to dominate scientific research. To figure out why Stanford specifically and Central California more generally played such a surprising role in America's innovation economy, I needed to find an expert. So I decided to talk with Margaret O'Meara, a professor of history at the University of Washington and the author of a recently released Penguin Press book, The Code: Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Welcome to the show, Margaret.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're talking about Silicon Valley in a particular location in California. Of course, that's not the only tech hub in the U.S. In fact, long before Silicon Valley was synonymous in people's minds with technology innovation, there was the Route 128 corridor outside Boston that had that distinction because of all the research at MIT, Harvard, and major corporate research labs. So why was it that the baton was, in a sense, passed? Why didn't Silicon Valley just grow in Massachusetts or expand in Massachusetts rather than why did it move to California?
That's a great question. Yeah. If you go back 100 years when, there was a lot going on in Boston, Harvard, MIT, early companies like Raytheon that were spinning out of those institutions. And meanwhile, out in the valley, the it was best known for growing fruit. It was the nation's capital of prune production. that was really what made its name. Where things started to turn significantly was with World War II and the Pacific Theater, which, of course, there's a great deal of military activity up and down the Pacific Coast before the war, but particularly escalates during the war. And then after the war, of course, the World War II is succeeded by the Cold War and an unprecedented turn by the U.S. government into not only kind of ongoing enlargement of military spending and the growth of what Dwight Eisenhower famously dubbed the military-industrial complex, but also the U.S. for the first time getting in the business of supporting and investing in basic scientific research and development and education. And a lot of that money flowed to higher education institutions.
California had another advantage over Massachusetts, which is that the state had prohibited what are known as non-compete clauses in employment contracts. Those contracts allow companies to lock their employees into their jobs by prohibiting them from going to work for competitors. So if you were, say, an engineer at eBay, you couldn't go work in a similar job at Shopify or at a startup. That's bad for innovation, but a place without non-compete agreements then had a real advantage in attracting top-tier talent who liked the flexibility and security of being able to move between employers at will. So I asked Margaret about the implications of California's non-compete ban.
Yeah, so when you ban non-compete agreements and look for, most of the states in the United States don't ban them. Essentially you allow people to hop from one company to a direct competitor without being penalized. You're able to do that. You're able to job hop, and you're able to job hop within an industry within closely related industries. So what it does is it allows a lot of cross-pollination from company to company. And the cool thing, the crazy thing about this whole thing is that the California's non-enforcement of non-compete clauses in employment contracts is not a product of the tech revolution. It wasn't anything that had to do with it at all. In fact, it's this crazy accident of history. It dates from the late 19th century when California is crafting its first constitution, trying to reconcile these different systems of, Mexican, Spanish, English, American legal systems. And it's just happenstance. And it happened to be that way. But it turned out that was one of a number of particular kind of conditions in California, sort of California specific things that really enabled this very particular business culture of sort of small to medium-sized enterprises in the beginning, and now including larger enterprises as things move on. It enables the free movement of people, and the free movement of people and capital is absolutely, in many dimensions, absolutely critical to the American tech story, and particularly in California, it's done it, enabled that. In this sort of funny, who knew? I think back in the 1870s, the people who were writing California's Constitution never would have imagined that they were enabling this sort of thing.
It seems like there's two stages in the history of Silicon Valley. And today folks are most familiar with this later stage, which is everything built on top of the internet, a lot of software applications and kind of digital tech. But the Silicon part of Silicon Valley is a reference to the first stage, where it is stuff being produced for the military, hardware, integrated circuits, semiconductors, microchips. So it seems like the conversation about how we got to Silicon Valley, might be a different story, because we're talking in a sense about two different eras in Silicon Valley. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they're definitely, I think of Silicon Valley 1.0 and 2.0, that really, in a way, it's just not just a matter of switching from being a hardware-focused place that was also happened to be a manufacturing center to a place that was all about software, was and is all about software, but it's also one of scale. If you look in, really up through the 1990s, I mean, the Valley was, look, it wasn't unimportant. It was, making important things that a lot of people used. It had these companies that were on the covers of magazines. It was a big deal. But when you, and I really only fully kind of realized the difference when I was putting the book together, which starts in the 40s and ends with pretty much yesterday, how the scale just scales up so massively in the 21st century, that these companies become bigger and richer, and their products are, look, it's impossible, pretty much impossible to get through your day in the modern United States, even if you decided, I'm going to delete Facebook, I'm going to be a Luddite, I'm not going to have anything to do with these things. You know what? Even if you've decided you're going to live radically offline, you went and bought something at a store whose transaction software was, powered by Microsoft or Amazon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost impossible to avoid the products of the big five, three of which are based in Silicon Valley, two of which are based here in my town of Seattle. And that's different, but they're really connected, and I think they're connected in a number of ways. One is sort of technological. The hardware is, enables the software and vice versa. And of course, the hardware business doesn't go away. You still have Cisco making
sure
routers. You still have all these big giant companies that don't get as much attention. Like Intel continues to be one of the most important tech companies in the world, and it's making hardware, and it's been around since the late 60s. But another really important connective tissue, and I think this is, I find this very important in understanding why these companies and their leadership, the choices they're making, the business strategy they're adopting, is very much shaped by the business culture that was established really with the semiconductor industry in the 60s and 70s. These ideas, idea of growth, growing fast, getting zero to one, getting, creating a market and taking it over, which has been incredibly successful. And it, quite frankly, is one of the reasons that some of today's tech giants are getting in trouble, because they have, kind of had this head of growth, this growth mindset, and this focus on, this is what we're doing. We're building products. We're building the best possible product. We're bringing it to the best, biggest market possible, and not realizing that, if you build an incredibly powerful search algorithm, or you build an incredibly viral social network, that actually that can have negative externalities that you don't expect when it gets that big and that pervasive.
But the story of the rise of Silicon Valley, it's not just a California story, it's also specifically a Stanford University story. step back to California and the history of why Silicon Valley. So we're in the prune fields, prune orchards. I don't know how prunes grow. Prune orchards of California. You have Stanford University there, but you actually have a great line in your book. Like today we hear the word Stanford and we think, oh, you know, like Ivy League, you know, high, top tier university. But you have a line in the book where you describe Stanford as, quote, outsiders were a touch more surprised by Stanford, once written off as the sentimental folly of a 19th century robber baron and his wife, a school best known for its pretty scenery, rugged football team, and Herbert Hoover, which is a great line. So Stanford's there. It clearly Stanford plays an important role in the story. How does Stanford become that kind of central player?
Yeah, Stanford plays an absolutely critical role in this story. It's the hub, and it's not just the institution. It's the structure of the institution, which was set up by that sentimental robber baron Leland Stanford and his wife Jane, and also by the leadership, the mid 20th century leadership, the choices that individual leaders made at Stanford to really remake it into what became the ultimate Cold War university. If you dial back to Stanford's founding, and it opened in 1890. It was found, you look at its founding grant, which actually you can go and Google, you can find it online. It's really interesting to look at the document itself. And it's very, very different from, say, the founding mission or the guiding mission of Ivy League schools like Harvard. Harvard and Yale were founded in the 17th century to educate future clergymen and lawyers. They were liberal arts institutions for the elite.
Yeah.
And they've had a certain, their mission has been shaped by that subsequently. Stanford, on the other hand, was a product of the 19th century industrial age. It says explicitly in the founding grant, I'm going to paraphrase this, but effectively, the purpose of this university is for its students and graduates to bring something useful into the world. And there was a great deal of latitude. When you get sort of fast forward half a century, this is an institution that on the outside kind of looks like a lot of other and is trying to be like a lot of other elite private institutions, but hasn't quite gotten there yet. But there is a lot of latitude that its leaders have in kind of how it structures itself. There are no rules on kind of, making sure you have, a full roster of humanities departments, for example. And so a really instrumental person in the story is a guy named Fred Terman, who was actually a born and bred son of a faculty member at Stanford, who becomes a faculty member there, an engineer, electrical engineer, and becomes dean of engineering, and then later becomes provost. And during World War II, he is back in in Boston, actually, in Cambridge, working like many other engineers on the war effort related to the Manhattan Project and other things, and an effort that was led by Terman's graduate advisor, a guy from MIT named Vannevar Bush, with a very funny first name. And Terman realized that Bush was working with Presidents Roosevelt and Truman to build a science, sort of permanent science complex, where the government was going to start on a permanent basis putting a lot of money into colleges and universities and both as contractor and also for education. And so Terman comes back to Stanford in 1945 and says, we got to get in on this action, effectively. this is going to be our ticket. And so he, working with the then president of Stanford and other leaders of Stanford, really remade the entire curriculum, beefed up physics, beefed up engineering, built whole programs that were centered around cutting edge digital technologies like silicon semiconductor manufacturer, and really became a leader and a partner with industry, and partnered with industry in ways that were unheard of at the time. I don't think every public or private university should, want to do exactly what Stanford did. They kind of made some sacrifices along the way. You can't be good at everything. And it was and is a very technically focused institution. And that's not necessarily what, say a public university like the University of California at Berkeley was able to or should do. There's a public mission of higher education that that sometimes can go against this, very utilitarian, build it up so you're the ultimate in electrical engineering and physics. Some people say, well, why didn't Berkeley, Berkeley's absolutely really critical to the tech story. But Berkeley functions in a very different way than Stanford does, in part because it's a public university. And Stanford, as a private institution, had a great deal of latitude to remake its curriculum, to focus, to build up its focus on sciences and engineering in a way that was absolutely perfect for the times, took advantage of all of this money flowing westward from the Defense Department and the atomic, what was the Atomic Energy Commission, which is now the Department of Energy, all of these big federal agencies that are just pouring money into advanced scientific research and development. And Stanford just saw that opportunity. And its leaders grabbed it and ran with it.
And that flexibility is, I mean, I was struck reading your book. Terman and I suppose others in leadership there really were willing to try new things. I mean, one of which was not just an academic department, it was their Office of Technology Leasing, which I can tell, I mean, these days most schools have one of these units that license their research out to corporations. Yep. Maybe explain for our audience, what are those? Why was this such a pioneering thing that Stanford was doing? I think theirs is 1970.
And so Stanford was ahead of the game, and it was not alone in thinking about ways to commercialize the technologies that are coming out of its labs. And the this sort of story of tech transfer is it's an IT story for sure. I mean, Google's foundational technologies were licensed by Stanford and greatly enriched Stanford when Google went big. But it is also very much a biotech story. So I think that this is where we get into another, you know, core industry that's growing up in and around the Valley, and other parts, other tech hubs during the 70s and into the 80s, which is biotech, you know, that is one, you know, when you're thinking about computer hardware and software, you know, the story is not just that of the technology itself. It's also the people who develop and build that technology. And on the IT sort of that side of things, you know, Stanford's perhaps greatest spinoff has been the people, its graduates, the people who graduated from there, not necessarily the things that were germinated in its labs. But on the bio side, you know, you have to have you need to have a lab to develop the foundational products you know, for biotechnology. It's a very different it's a very different process of product development and marketing, and it's a longer time frame. And that is where making it easy for the products of government-sponsored university research to be commercialized was absolutely instrumental in encouraging a revolution in biotechnology and then seeding a whole new set of companies, both in the Valley and elsewhere, that have you know, transformed medicine and also have been incredible business success stories on their own.
Now, Stanford made those changes for a pretty basic reason. It was the Great Depression. Finances were tight, and so the university sought corporate sponsors for basic scientific research. Later on, as we'll discuss in our next episode, they looked to the military for funding, which had all kinds of ramifications for good and for ill. Incentives do matter. But that's not only true on the institutional level, it matters on the level of individual researchers as well. And those individual incentives were about to drastically change. You see, prior to the 70s and 80s, a university-based scientist received relatively little financial reward for the research they performed. Now, sometimes corporations would buy patents off of researchers, but the big companies had all the leverage in the negotiations. On the other hand, if you took government research grants, the laws that then stood said that the government owned most of the resulting patents, leaving nothing for the researcher themselves. But in the 1970s, two things changed on both fronts. First, in 1970, Stanford created the first Office of Technology Licensing, which was a university clearinghouse for patentable research. If your research led to a patent, in exchange for splitting any proceeds from that research three ways between the researcher, their department, and the university, the university would license out the use of the patent, though not ownership, to, you know, companies that wanted to use that basic research. The other change came in 1980, when Congress passed a key bipartisan piece of legislation called the Bayh-Dole Act, which meant that the government no longer claimed patent rights for projects supported with government grants. I asked Margaret about how these two developments changed the incentive structure for researchers. And maybe you can describe for our audience what it was like. Now, this is both a story about before these kind of licensing offices at universities, but also before the what was known as the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980. And so it's at the tail end. One's kind of the development of these offices is at the beginning of the 70s. One's kind of at the tail end of the 70s. And my understanding is that it kind of dramatically changes the incentives for university researchers and for universities themselves when it comes to encouraging innovation. Why was that?
Well, it's interesting. It's a real kind of reformulation of what government funded research is for. And when you go to the, you know, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, you know, government research was or academic research sponsored by government contracts was not seen as a, you know, pathway to future entrepreneurship and wealth building. It was a, you know, competing with the Soviets in scientific production and
right.
building better
guns,
you know, building up the science complex of the United States. Commercialization wasn't completely out of it, but that wasn't the main end. When you get to the 70s and the 80s, there's now this part of it is, you know, the talented scientists and engineers realize that they, you know, they could stay in academia and they could make a certain amount of money and they could, you know, do this, or they could commercialize what they're doing and kind of, you know, have this incredible entrepreneurial future. Stanford was, you know, aside from even before it had the Office of Technology Licensing, was ahead of its time in allowing its faculty to consult for industry as well as hold their day job as faculty members. So they were able to essentially make some money on the side and to, you know, to be on corporate boards, to be technical advisors, to be, you know, to kind of get a piece of the action. And so, you know, that is, you know, now there are these commercial incentives for scientific people, personnel, to do things outside of academia. And so that's one thing. That's one kind of thing that's precipitating this turn towards, let's find a way to make this technology more easily commercializable. But the other thing, and this is kind of where, again and again, you know, when you need to sort of integrate the story of tech with the broader story of American history, and particularly American political history, but also business history, to really understand what's going on. So think about the 70s. What's going on in the 70s? Well, first of all, the Vietnam War is, you know, not loved by anybody.
No.
wherever you are on the political spectrum, you're pretty much against it. So there's a very unpopular war and a consequent decline in military spending after the war, real cutbacks in the size of the military. So those contracts aren't flowing anymore like they used to. There isn't as much military activity. A pivot during the Nixon era towards government investment in health, creation of the NIH, these other health agencies that are seeding new discoveries, again, kind of having the stimulating new innovation that is potentially commercializable. And then you have a kind of crisis in American business, right? American manufacturing. You've got competition from Japan. You've got oil crises, stagflation. And so policymakers in Washington, and we see this throughout the kind of Nixon and the Ford administrations, but also into Carter, are like, okay, what can we do to stimulate a new generation of industry? And how can science-based industry help bring the economy back? And so all of these things are feeding into increased pressure for the rules to be changed on how all of the you know, what's being conceived in university labs, how you can commercialize it. And a lot of the big universities that have a lot of research, University of Wisconsin was really ahead of the game, was really the first mover in technology, creating sort of a tech transfer office. But also Stanford, MIT, other big dogs are starting to do some of this commercialization that really went, by the time you get to Bayh-Dole in 1980, it kind of universalizes something that some of the elite research institutions have already figured out a way to do. It's significant that Bayh from Indiana and Dole from Kansas are the two sponsors of it. The reason that they were in it was not just because they cared about the commercialization of scientific research, but also because they wanted the universities and institutions in their states to be able to share in to as commercialize as easily as these other big players were doing. And so in a way, it was a kind of effort to democratize the process of commercialization and spread it across the country.
These two changes, university licensing offices and the Bayh-Dole Act, had huge effects. Consider the difference for university researchers themselves. Licensing offices leveled the playing field as they negotiated with big corporations, resulting in more money for inventors themselves. Before this, average revenue for an inventor was about 15% of proceeds. That more than doubled to 33%. And universities started making bank too, with Stanford's licensing revenues in the 13 years prior to 1970 totaling a mere $3,000. In the 50 years since, that number has been more than $2 billion. And Bayh-Dole had perhaps an even greater impact. Before 1980, these government-held patents were woefully underutilized. Consider that when the law was passed, federal agencies owned 28,000 active patents, but fewer than 5% of them were licensed. Contrast that with a control group, the small number of patents funded by government grants that the government did allow companies to freely use. They had a utilization rate of 25 to 30%, 5 to 6 times higher. Now, in addition, there were entire fields of research that languished prior to Bayh-Dole because policymakers, well, you know, they're a risk-averse set of people who tend to be focused on any potential downsides to the exclusion of potential upsides to innovation. When government held the patents, researchers and companies were constantly worried that Congress or federal agencies would prohibit or delay development of new technology. Like, for example, this was a constant concern in early biotech research into recombinant DNA. That fear of political tinkering was lessened, although not removed, after Bayh-Dole. But I'm afraid that these crucial deregulatory and market-responsive decisions just might not be possible any longer in our current political environment. So I asked Margaret, who actually worked in politics prior to becoming a historian, to compare the political context of the 1970s and 80s with today in terms of, you know, openness towards pro-innovation policy. It's such a striking moment, I mean, in terms of the political economy, that at this moment, late 70s, early 80s, there's this bipartisan kind of pro-tech movement. I mean, Bayh-Dole, you've got, you know, everyone from Michael Dukakis to Al Gore to Ronald Reagan. I mean, you have from both political parties across the political spectrum, there are folks who are in favor of certain forms of deregulation for the sake of technological innovation and finding commercial applications that will help the economy grow because of, you know, the economic doldrums. Everyone wants to get out of the 70s economy, which was not a great time for, you know, for lots of good reasons. But today, it feels like we're moving into the inverse of that, which is you can maybe see the first inklings of a bipartisan anti-tech push, which is concerned about over-commercialization and people, economic growth at the cost of exploitation. Do you see a parallel, kind of an inverted parallel there? How do you think about that yourself?
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I mean, that just in the swing from both parties being such champions of tech and really been, you know, all the things that the tech industry has been able to do in the last quarter century, both for good or for ill, have really been a kind of consequence of both Republicans and Democrats. They've been arguing about a lot since the 90s, but in the 80s. But the one thing that a lot of them tended to agree upon was we need to create a runway for Silicon Valley companies to grow. And now what we have is the consequences of that growth. And it's been a great deal of economic concentration. You know, the parallel that what this reminds me of a lot is I go back to Teddy Roosevelt. I go back to the first decade of the 20th century. This reminds me a lot of the political dynamics that we saw in the progressive era, the response to the first Gilded Age, the growth of a whole set of new tech, high tech industries, railroads, steel, oil, you know, brand new industries that hadn't existed before, that had grown in a essentially deregulated environment to become enormous and to become inescapable, right? An American of 1905 could not go to the grocery store without, you know, having to pay prices that were essentially set by, you know, the sugar trust or one of these giant conglomerates. They couldn't get on a train to go to the next town without, you know, the ticket they were paying was set by these giant railroad companies, and on and on and on. And so, you know, there's a political backlash to that. On both parties, you know, you go back to, again, to the first decade of the 20th century, you have Teddy Roosevelt, and you have have Woodrow Wilson, both with sort of different ideas about the means to the way to respond to the growth of large companies, but are both have regulatory responses of some kind. Roosevelt is less a trust buster than he has a than he gets a reputation for. He was more of a regulator. He, you know, believed in guardrails. He could be big, but you just need to have some rules of the road. Where Wilson was a, you know, Jeffersonian all the way. He wanted to small, break them up. So, you know, and out of that moment come the regulatory agencies that are still, you know, the ones that we're turning to say, okay, Federal Trade Commission, what's, you know, what are you going to do about Facebook? So I see, you know, in a way it's not surprising to me that this has been the response and that it's a bipartisan response. And economic concentration is, you know, it can have a, it can quash innovation. There are reasons that we try to find some way to kind of create a countervailing force against that, so that there's still opportunities for the next generation of entrepreneurs to get some, you know, get a foothold in the market.
Now, you know, we're historians, so future prediction, not really in our bailiwick. But are there any contemporary trends in American society, economy, politics that make you wonder if that next major tech hub might be somewhere else in the U.S. or somewhere else in the world? And I guess I'm asking, where do you think the next cities of knowledge might be?
It's really interesting. I've been really a kind of a Debbie Downer on that question for a long time. And when people are like, how can we build another Silicon Valley? And I was like, well, you can't really, which is, I realized I could have had a multi-million dollar consulting career had I had a different answer, but I'm too much of a truth teller, I guess.
Oh, man.
But let me tell you, I'm kind of changing. I think what we're seeing, particularly in the last few years, is kind of challenging what I had concluded. And I think that was, my conclusion was the right one for a very long time, but I have, especially in the last, you know, recently, just in traveling and talking to people around the country and around the world and seeing what's going on, and the actual, not just the kind of, oh, we're building a silicon something and we're calling it silicon and thus it will come. We're going to build this beautiful research park and everyone's going to show up. I've visited a lot of kind of deadly research parks or research parks that really wanted to be something and didn't become that. But now, in the last few years, I go, and I think this has to do with tech also moving back to the center of cities in the U.S. and the rest of the world, where there's kind of more, you know, it's not about building a place, it's about actually building community and building a real vibrant economic, you know, agglomeration. There's stuff going on. And I think it has to do with, you know, the fact that tech software has indeed eaten the world. Mark Andreessen's prediction in 2011 was right, that software is everywhere. Everywhere is a technology company. So you can be in Kansas City, you can be in Lisbon, Portugal, you can be, you know, pretty much anywhere, and you can build a viable tech business. The geography is really changing. I think that the next gen is, you know, the industry is global. Silicon Valley isn't a place anymore. It's a global network. But here's where, you know, I'm thinking a lot, and I know a lot of people, listening and people I talk to are thinking a lot about China.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other rising tech economy. And I look at China and I see a place that is doing a lot of things. They looked at the Cold War U.S. and they took notes. They're doing a lot of things the U.S. did back then and has doing less of, like investing in advanced technologies, investing in higher education at scale, building cities, building infrastructure at scale, you know, able to do that because of its structure of government. You're able, it's a lot easier to
cut through red tape,
build a new neighborhood or build a highway when you don't have a liberal democracy. there's that.
Yeah, for good or for ill.
But an amazing amount of entrepreneurship. And, you know, meanwhile, the U.S. is taking some of the things that made it great, like investing in R&D, investing in higher ed, both public and private, creating an amazing escalator of opportunity for young people to get on and get educated and do amazing things. Steve Jobs' dad did not graduate high school.
Wow.
Like, he's not, you know, the people who are the icons of the industry that we look up to, they were by and large coming from pretty modest backgrounds. They were not born on third base.
Yeah.
And And that has, it has changed. You know, the startup hustle right now, you want to go, you know, be, you know, come out of college and start your own company, live on ramen noodles for 6 months in San Francisco. Well, I hope you have a rich uncle. I mean, you know, or I hope you don't have, you know, family back in your home country that you need to send money to make sure that they, their house, you know, they have a roof over their head. Yeah. It becomes exclusionary. And I think that that's, you know, that's not liberty. That's not opportunity. And look, it, you know, China's not going to provide that sort of liberty and opportunity, but the U.S. did, and it can do that again. And I think that involves a real reckoning with, you know, what is the role of the state and the role of policy in this sort of productive, generative, opportunity creating environment that actually does one better from what we've done before. You know, we created opportunity for a whole bunch of Americans, but they were usually guys. They were usually, you know, certain came from, there were a lot of people who were left out of that. And, you know, how can we do it one better going forward?
We at Building Tomorrow would argue that putting a thumb on the scale often means taking a thumb off the scale, looking to markets in the private sector for innovation rather than relying on government grants, bureaucratic management, and industrial policy. When California encouraged labor freedom and mobility by banning non-compete clauses, it had positive results. When the U.S. after World War II opted against government-run research labs like those in other countries and went instead with a hybrid model of government grants for private researchers, it had positive results. When Baidu took hidebound government middlemen out of the patent licensing process, it had positive results. Incentives work, markets work, and the resulting efflorescence of spontaneous order that erupted in Central California sure worked beyond the wildest imaginings of even the most optimistic observers back in the day. In any case, that's our show. We'll return in 2 weeks with the final episode in our Silicon Valley series. Until then, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.